VentureCast.
First thing I got to ask is, where'd the title come from?
Well, obviously, it's a nod to Hammer of the Gods, the infamous Led Zeppelin biography, which the three of us no doubt read during the 80s, causing our jaws to drop, our heads to spin, and wishing we could, we too could, you know.
Traveled with them?
Yeah.
live a night as Led Zeppelin?
Just one night.
Yeah.
And so that book made an impression on me because it was so epic, and it presented the rowdy, bawdy side of Led Zeppelin that had been sort of kept from us. You know, I don't know how much of it is true. To me, it doesn't matter how much it was true. Even if it's fiction, it's thrilling. It's an exciting read, and it's well written.
Yeah.
And I wanted to sort of tip my hat to that era of music, you know, the 70s going into the 80s. So many 80s bands, of course, were hugely influenced by Led Zeppelin. They were all trying to imitate that band and then take it even further, but it never really worked.
Welcome, fellow Leshes. Come on in, pull up a bar stool, and enjoy some cocktails with Dimples and the Beard.
By now, the world knows what a brilliant singer I am because they've watched our episode with the Traveling Suitcase and they've seen my thrash metal in action. So, oh, never mind. That is going to be part of it. Remember, because he went, and this is how it happened. And I'm going to edit that clip in to the, so that'll be in the podcast.
I uploaded mine to the Google.
To the Google
Drive.
Cool. I haven't even seen myself screaming yet. I haven't watched it. Grace got, we tried to show it to Grace and she got bored before I even got to that part. So she's like, you guys suck.
With me singing? She's like,
both
I'm
of
done.
Us singing, yeah. Yeah. She's like, you guys are terrible. Like,
wait a minute. We need to talk. I need to talk with her.
Well, you had your chance yesterday.
Leah had my chance yesterday?
You had your chance yesterday.
Well, I didn't know she saw our clip.
Oh. She did. Well, she kind of did. I mean, she saw like the first 10 seconds of it and then went, you guys suck. Bye. I think she farted and walked away.
You suck.
Yeah.
Got one.
So?
I thought we were brilliant.
I don't know. I have to go back and review the footage now. It was like everybody else was just fucked up as I was at that moment. So they were all like, yeah, you're awesome. And then I think everybody was like, no, you were awesome. No.
Yes. I mean, that's usually how it goes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Without a doubt. But it was fun.
It was a lot of fucking fun. Thank you, Traveling Suitcase.
It was a lot of fun.
Making my 50th birthday bearable. You want to open the...
Did you, you know, at all want to say anything about me serenading you a little bit or anything?
I mean, don't get fucking needy. Open the tavern and we'll talk. I gotta get a little sloshy before I start to get sappy. You did.
Tavern's now open.
I asked. I said to Leah on the way home the next day or someday, whatever, someday this week or whatever. I was like, "Did you have anything? Did you know anything about that?" And she's like, "No." I'm like, "I guess I know who the better friend is, don't I?" You didn't sing to me, so
no clue.
No, she sang to me later, if you know what I mean.
Into your microphone.
No, that was dumb. No, you serenaded me with REM's "This One Goes Out to the One I Love" / "The Cult Firewoman."
Yep, sure. It is now.
I could not figure that out for the life of me. Every time I started doing the fire, it just turned into fire. Yeah, from
well, it was dumb when I went to look at the lyrics, which I knew that verse.
Just the line.
And then after that, I'm like, oh, he actually is just yelling fire. And I don't know why.
I don't know either.
But that's what he's yelling is fire.
Yeah, I know.
I know. I guess I never thought about it.
But you know the song Firewoman by the
way. Oh, absolutely. Yep. I get it. But
so, yeah,
I knew in my head because I had to learn the lyrics.
Yeah, you did a great job learning the lyrics. There's only like 6 lyrics to this whole song you picked.
Well, that was the other funny part is I'm like, there's literally 4 lines to the song, yeah. And they just repeat it.
Yeah.
and it's a classic, and they are called geniuses for this.
It's simple in its simplicity. It's beautiful in its simplicity.
Well, it's very simplest.
Can you open the tavern? Oh, you did.
I did.
Did you say that?
I did.
Holy shit, I missed it. Welcome back to another episode of Cocktails with Dimples in the Beard. Smart guy edition. We got a guy who's smart. He's a PhD and another
in creative writing.
Another D and a
he's got kinds of D's.
He's got all the D's.
He does not have double D's.
No, that's no. You can see those on most of our episodes though. So
if you recall,
I don't.
A couple episodes ago that have been released, it was we are not having any more dudes on this podcast. What are we having on tonight?
A dude.
A dude.
I'm telling you what though. Let me tell you why we're having this guy on. Because I'm hedging my bet. I need something good to happen in my life if I want to retire, if I want to see the world. I'm hedging my bet on this book. I'm putting my money down on this book. This is the next Hunger Games. So I want to be early. I want to be early entry.
We are it. It's not even published yet.
I know.
It's not out.
Look at that. Doesn't come out for a week.
We got a copy.
We do. And we've had it for months.
I had it for the weekend. Yeah. So I didn't realize months, but not for sale or library circulation, promotional purposes only. Months, huh?
It's not even corrected.
Months.
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 Yeah, we got that a couple months ago. When I got it, I was like,
months.
When I got it, I was like, if I read a chapter a day, I'll be able to give it to him with like a month to go.
Yep.
I didn't read a chapter a day.
And then
towards the end, I started to read about five chapters a day.
Can I swing by and pick up that book that we're at the end of the weekend?
I literally finished it like a day before you picked it up. 2 days, I think.
I thought, well, at least I'll put a pressure on him. I'm not picking it up now, but I'll pick it up tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
So I had to whisk through it. Good thing it was a good book.
It is action from the fucking page, the opening page to the end of the book. It's nonstop. So
that helps dummy brain like me, though. This is what I did to get through it.
You fall asleep a few times? Not
all. Let's understand. I fall asleep during any book. Read it lying in bed.
Yeah, I don't. That's not a bad thing. That's not saying something bad about the book.
It's not. But so this is what I did before I started is
jerked off.
I for sure fall asleep.
That's true.
I mean, even when I'm starting to read on the pot, I'd fall asleep. Reading a book.
When you're starting to jerk off on the pot? Oh, I thought you said when you were jerking off on the podcast.
I read a book, jerk off, and take a shit at the same time. I don't know where that came from. I walked around. I held the book and I walked around.
So you got your steps in and you...
I guess. If I had a thing, I'd have got my steps in. Yep. It helped. And when I did sit down, it was one of the least dozing offs.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's action packed. I'm excited to talk to him, Jared Keene. So we don't do a lot of them with smart people. I mean, that sounded terrible.
Apologize to every one of our guests that have ever been on. Let me apologize first for what you just said.
I might have to edit that out.
Please don't take it personal.
I didn't.
He meant he was talking about us.
I didn't. I'm just not used to. I'm not used to having somebody with a D in, like we said, a D in their title.
PhD.
Yeah. I mean, yes. Actually, the episode. Wow. I'm flailing right now. Hold on. The episode that's
so we'll just get...
right now. We're not doing that. I'm not cutting this. The episode that's out right now is with Victoria Fuller, who is genius. So, yeah, we've had. Everybody who's been on has been.
We have not had a dumb guest yet.
We have.
Not doing anything. Any favors.
We've had one.
Figure it out. Anyways, do us a favor. Like, subscribe, share with your friends, leave a comment. Please, please, please call us. Obviously, we're idiots, so call us some idiots. One or both. But we do not want to keep a smart man waiting.
Smart man. So without further ado, the author of Hammer of the Dogs, Jarrett Keene. So thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Jarrett Keane, the author of Hammer the Dogs and a professor at University of Nevada.
That's correct. I am the comic book professor. I teach the graphic novel here in Las Vegas, much to the jealousy and irritation of my colleagues.
Yes, we'll get into that in a bit about how common that is.
I got to admit, when we were contacted about the book and I saw that you did graphic novels, I thought it was a graphic novel. Mm. And then when it showed up, I went, oh, I got to read all this? But
yeah.
I'd love a graphic novel in your mind.
Yeah, I'd love to produce a graphic novel. I just can't draw. And, the people that I want to get involved, they're already working for, you know, real companies, Marvel and DC. It's hard to get them on board for a little indie project.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would the goal be someday to turn this into a graphic novel?
Well, believe it or not, I prefer to see it as a telenovela on Univision or, Telemundo, like a streaming telenovela action.
Yeah. Adventure. Nice.
I've never seen one of those, and I'd like to see one.
Okay.
And what better project?
And what better person to start it?
So first thing I got to ask is, where'd the title come from?
Well, obviously, it's a nod to Hammer of the Gods, the infamous Led Zeppelin biography, which the three of us no doubt read during the 80s, causing our jaws to drop, our heads to spin, and wishing we too could
traveled with them.
Yeah.
live a night as Led Zeppelin.
just one night.
Just one night.
Yeah.
And so that book made an impression on me because it was so epic, and it presented the rowdy body side of Led Zeppelin that had been sort of kept from us. You know, I don't know how much of it is true. To me, it doesn't matter how much it was true. Even if it's fiction, it's thrilling. It's an exciting read, and it's well written.
Yeah.
And I wanted to sort of tip my hat to that era of music, you know, the 70s going into the 80s. So many 80s bands, of course, were hugely influenced by Led Zeppelin. They were all trying to imitate that band and then take it even further, but it never really worked.
No, it didn't. And they were such pioneers, that's for sure.
Yes. I mean, obviously, if you flip through the book, you know that I'm obsessed with Wasp, Alice Cooper, Twisted Sister, bands like this. I just I wanted to recapture that rock and roll energy from the 80s, even if a lot of it was, you know, Drek. That analog, no digital effects, no processing, just, you know, put microphones in front of these guys dressed as women and set them loose in the studio.
And now that you say that, it's the analog thing, it's kind of a cool juxtaposition between the book takes place a little bit in the future and it's very tech heavy and future tech heavy, but the music is all back to the analog days. Yeah. So it's kind of like, you know, it's, you would think in that you'd have all this upbeat EDM kind of music or something, but you brought it back to the, I like that.
No, Lash, the hero of the novel, Lash, hates electronic music because it reminds her of her environment, and she hates using the drones, even though she's very gifted at wielding them as weapons. And of course her father, the music reminds her of her missing father. And that's why she carries around that Walkman and blasts those cassette tapes, even as they disintegrate and fall apart on her.
Which I've had happen to me playing them over and over again back in the day.
I mean, we grew up with such limited technology, and yet for some reason, all of that popular culture was so powerful for us, to us. It moved us more than anything we purchase and enjoy now. You know, even the movies from the 80s, you know, this is pre-CGI. Hammer of the Dogs is a tribute to that era in storytelling. You know, I'm talking specifically about the great films like Conan the Barbarian, Red Dawn,
yeah,
you know, Legend, Labyrinth, Tron, Howard the Duck, Buckaroo Banzai.
Wait, whoa, Howard the Duck.
It's a grower.
I own it and cherish it, but not many people do.
He owns everything. I'm looking at a wall of 3,000 plus DVDs back here. So It's no surprise he owns Howard the Duck.
Absolutely right. Not.
And well, that's why I wanted to jump into this podcast, because I wanted to be with some people that I can get along with and see the world my way.
But yeah, it is nice. Like you, you're right in our age range, and it's cool to, like I said, all the music from the book is music I listened to growing up. So that was fun. Is the character Dio named after Ronnie James Dio, essentially?
Oh yeah, obviously. Yeah. I mean, much different. You know, this is a sort of pudgy Mexican kid who. who loves Lash and is a fierce warrior in his own right. And I just wanted to, you know, pay tribute with these characters to the Goonies, that, you know, band of misfits doing their best to, to save the city. That's what they're trying to do in the Goonies. And that's what Lash is doing in her own way by, you know, using these drones to fight the warlords who are basically on a power trip. And, you know, I think with a book like this, it's just a little bit weird because I wrote it for young people, but I layered in all these, not Easter eggs, but all these little, you know, references for baby boomers, Gen Xers, millennials. Yeah. I wanted to sort of put everything I knew about manga, anime, and, you know, World War II comics and, you know, telenovelas and, just everything that I, you know, roller skating rinks, everything that I loved and cherished, I wanted to like push into this book. And because of that, the book kind of almost spins off, you know, almost goes off the rails completely. But I did that intentionally. I wanted it to be an unforgettable experience and more visceral than some other books that have attempted to, you know, have attempted this retro pop culture approach.
What I said in the opening before we had you on is, you know, reading it, it's action from page one until page. I don't know what the final man, because we got 200. One of the special copies, but all 200 pages of ours are action packed, and it doesn't stop until the last scene. I mean, there's no
and it spawns off in a lot of different ways. Yeah. So that's you got a lot packed into the 200 pages. Was that your goal when you started? Is not to let up?
Yes, but I still cut away. I think it stands now at 70,000 words. I cut 20,000 words out of the book because I didn't want there to be any fat, any boring parts. You know, like when you're watching a classic film like Howard the Duck, you sit there and you watch the scene. You're like, oh, this doesn't really work. They could have cut this away, you know, and they didn't. They left it in.
Yeah.
And I just wanted this to be like the perfect 89-minute film, you know. I really miss those days.
Like the '80s.
Yeah.
Yes. When filmmakers were not scared to just give you 90 minutes of adrenaline.
Yeah.
Megaforce is a big influence on this, on this book. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
What is I don't know if I know what that is. Do you know what that is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Of course you do.
Well, it's funny after reading into the book and looking up on you or researching you a little bit. I had just watched this weekend, and I can't remember who it is. It was on YouTube, and he told his 10 favorite, with honorable mentions, fantasy films of the 80s.
Yes.
You know, Beastmaster and what was it? Thor.
Roll.
What was it?
Roll.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. You know, and he went through them all, and Conan, of course, was on there. It was fun to listen to that, you know, and then, of course, his perception of, I loved them as a kid. I still love this one, or they love it more. And that one I loved, I hate now, or, you know, don't like now because you grow, but you still appreciate that era when they
just. The other thing that's great about that era, too, is that like all the best movies feature women protagonists, you know, like Ellen Ripley, Sarah Connor, Sarah Williams from, you know, Labyrinth. Sheena, Red Sonja, I mean, the Supergirl. I love these films growing up, and I wanted to create a powerful woman, badass protagonist that harkened back to that era when characters were allowed to have flaws. You know, today it's a little too much. Like all the women heroes they're too perfect, and they do everything right the first time. And I wanted to present a character that, you know, totally messed things up for, you know, she gets captured by the warlord stupidly.
Yeah. And then, right. Little, you know, hothead, yeah.
And does everything is done with disastrous results. And I wanted the character to learn how to be a leader. how to be a champion, how to save the city. And that required her changing, you know, adapting and not, you know, bullheadedly thinking that the world has to adjust to her.
Right.
That's not the reality of existence. The reality of existence is either you adapt or you die. And she has to do that. You know, it bothers her. She doesn't want to do it.
Right.
But in order to save her friends, save, you know, her father, save the city, that's what she has to do. And I really wanted to get that message across because I'm utterly grossed out by the, you know, just embrace yourself philosophy. Be who you really are. And that's, you know, that's crap. That never works out.
Yeah.
Always ends up badly if you try to do that in the real world. You know, what makes us human is our ability to change, to transform, to become sometimes somebody else. I mean, this is what life is really about. And I wanted to zero in on that and create this unforgettable protagonist who, honestly, I didn't even write. I felt possessed nearly during some moments. Like, you know, she was telling me what to write.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. I don't believe in metaphysical stuff when it comes to writing. I was always like a journalist, just meet deadline, you know, knock out the pages, do the word count. But with writing this, I just felt compelled and just like I was, you know, just typing what the character wanted me to do.
Yeah.
Well, and it's and I have it written down here is when you mentioned Sarah Connors, that's what I thought of when I was reading the book.
Yes.
Is more, you know, all these people nowadays, the characters, and I've seen comparisons to, you know, Hunger Games and
sure.
Katniss and all that stuff. But catnip. As I did say catnip today, it's kind of what I feel about it. I have a sore spot with the Hunger Games. That's a different story.
Yeah, I do too. That's why I wrote this book. So
yeah, but who I thought of was, no, I'm envisioning more of a Sarah Connors. You know, she was thrown into this and she had to your point, change. So it came across to me.
I mean, think about those character arcs, those, you know, Ellen Ripley, Sarah Connor, think about how they begin and how they end up through not just one movie, you know, several movies.
Yeah.
Ripley's from Alien.
I know. Oh, I did know that.
You did?
I did.
Sometimes I have to explain to him.
Yeah.
She was on our underwear list.
She was.
She was on my number one.
Yes.
She was.
Right. Space underwear. I know the scene.
Yeah. Wow. As a little boy, you don't forget it.
it's right about here.
To watch those characters change in terms of how they interact with others, their own, you know, their personality, what they're fighting for. It was so amazing to observe that in the movie theaters, you know, and see it unfold, those character arcs. And that's what I'm after with Hammer of the Dogs, with Lash, who is cut from that mold, but also offers something new. You know, I really dug into the PTSD aspect, and also this idea of child soldiers. You know, having two teenagers in my house and watching them like merge with the machine, with the computers, the smartphones, the tablets, the PCs. You know, it's almost heartbreaking.
Yeah,
in some ways, this is a reaction to that. You know, I encourage young people just not to accept technology passively. I would like them to actively, you know, grab it, take it apart and rework it, or hack it, if you will, to suit their own needs and their own, you know, purposes, their own, to protect and cherish those things that they value.
Yeah. So where did the story originally come from? I mean, where'd the idea come from? Just inspiration from some of those kind of things out there?
Well, there's two things. The first is growing up and buying secondhand comics in the used bookstores here in town. And I kept encountering this title called Commandy, the Last Boy on Earth. It's written and drawn by the legendary Jack Kirby, co-creator of the Marvel Universe with Stan Lee. Mm-hmm. And it's this dystopian, you know, future shock world where Commandy, the young protagonist, is the sole surviving human in the sense that he's the only one who can speak. Like the, you know, mankind has become like animals and they can't speak and they just run around and get abused by the animals who are now in control and who are intelligent and who are articulate. So that made, you know, flipping the power structure upside down and backwards really made an impression on me. As a kid. And then the second thing was working in the Las Vegas casinos. Before I was a professor, I was writing casino propaganda for the employees, the biggest casino corporation on the planet. And so Las Vegas is a big convention town.
Yeah.
Drone tech conventions would gather in places like Mandalay Bay, Caesar's Palace. And because I worked in the hotel, I had a badge, you know, and I walked around and I would crash these drone tech conventions and inspect the latest, you know, killware and see how, you know, higher education, the tech sector, you know, military contractors and foreign governments were all, you know, they were all in cahoots in creating this drone verse. And there was this propaganda that was always put in your face, which is that drones are going to make our lives easier. You know, they're going to make things safer.
Amazon's going to send us packages with them. Yeah.
We've been hearing that for,
yeah, for
decades now. But it's not true that the drone tech is here to kill other people. And it was just a minor extrapolation to wonder, well, what if this gets into young people's hands? What's going to happen? You're going to have something a million times worse than Columbine, and it's going to be totally horrible. And that was where all of this began. So about 10 years ago, I had the idea. And then, of course, as many people, as it happened to many people, you know, COVID kind of inspired me to, you know, to get rolling.
Yeah.
You know, is this the end of the world? I'm going to write my book. I'm going to finish my book before before I croak from something I don't understand.
And, so your ideas come to you? Are you envisioning what you're going to write? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I see it like a movie, you know. I think we've all done that, especially those of us who love pop culture. We're in the shower, whatever. We see the beats of the film. We see the set pieces.
True. I do.
And I had like 10 of the set pieces, like, dun, 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 dun. And then once I started writing them, I had some momentum. And then it was just a matter of pushing all the way through till I had like, you know, 25 set pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. And,
I just wanted each set piece to be more out of control, zanier than the preceding one, which is how you get to a swarm of genetically modified flamingos, you know, attacking Lash and her drone bots, you know.
Well, I got to tell you, I was just at a zoo this past weekend, and I looked at the flamingos a little differently after reading your scene.
Sure.
So I was like, those fuckers could kill us, you know. They get out, we're screwed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, birds are weird, but I mean, I love them. I love flamingos, but I thought, what would make me not like a flamingo? And I just thought, you know, genetic modification. I'm sure it's here. I'm sure they've already got killer flamingos somewhere.
Well, and you talk about seeing it in a set piece for a movie. How iconic of a scene would that be with this? What do you call it, a flock of flamingos? I don't know.
Swarm
of flamingos. Yeah, coming in. I mean, just the color. What you could do with the color.
Oh, yeah,
it would be a beautiful scene.
With the sunset behind the ruined Luxor, it'd be amazing. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's how I saw this unfolding. That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah,
the flamingo is such an iconic bird for Las Vegas, and you know, because of the hotel and the and everything else. So, to me, it was just the perfect aviary weapon to use against drones.
Weapon, nice
aviary weapon.
At the same time, were you there? The songs in your head as well, what you envisioned, and did they stand true to the finished product of the book, or did the songs change throughout?
Oh no. I mean, I had a playlist of maybe 30 songs, and they were all bangers. They were all amazing. And, you know, some of them were like deep cuts, maybe like Iron Maiden's Killers, like from the second record, Killers, the title track. But I don't know. I just, and truth be told, I didn't even really enjoy hard rock glam metal from the 80s. I listened to a lot of it, like Motley Crue, but I didn't. I was always kind of like a.
we have a very, very heated debate that goes on between Kiss and Motley Crue, and who is the better of the two. And I am on the Motley Crue side, so.
And I'm on the right side.
Well, why not both? To me, like, that music is so, it's what the rougher kids listen to. Like, I was a little more sensitive. I listened to, you know, like Joy Division and like gothic, you know, music.
Sure.
And so I always kept like Poison and stuff like that a little bit at arm's length. But when I, you know, Lash, as I was saying, the character didn't want me to listen to that moody crap that I listened to as a teenager. She wanted me to listen to this stuff.
That's definitely not music she would have listened to.
Right. Yeah. You can't fight drones listening to, you know, I don't know, Sisters of Mercy or something.
The Cure?
Yeah, right? You need Motley Crue's...
You do. The battle, you know, songs.
You need Livewire or something like that.
You do. Oh. I assume that'll be in the second book.
Yes. I mean, I would love this first book to sell enough copies. You know, I think it only needs to sell like, you know, a few thousand copies for it to make it worth it for the publisher to let me try a second and third volume. And so I'm hoping to get some good sales and then finish this story, because Lash is calling me and to write it. I'm telling Lash, I'm not going to sit here with, you know, three unpublished novels sitting in my hard drive one at a time. You know, I've got to have a contract.
But you got to have a little something in the next episode.
Oh, yeah, I've got it. Oh, yeah.
There, you just haven't put it. Okay.
Yeah, she's going to take the fight to Russia, to China. The third book is on Mars, you know, fighting
drones. Perfect. On Mars.
I don't think that's a spoiler. I mean, you know, it has to go there.
Eventually.
I mean, we've all seen four John Wicks, right?
Yeah.
Lots of fun.
Four John Wicks, and they're still in the exact same spot. That's a bad analogy.
I still watch them. But I mean, I prefer action movies that, you know, grow and people get, you know, when you get on the road, and that's why I love Red Dawn so much, because it's just so expansive. And I love that kind of the sense that the world is growing, you know, like the world is bigger than the characters. Conan the Barbarian too is that way. And so I love that aspect. I don't like, you know, movies that all happen in one location. They make me crazy. I think Quentin Tarantino did a whole movie, Western movie, that was like in a cabin and then like, or a bar or something. I was like, we need to get moving. We need to get rolling.
I love them both, but
I do. Yes.
Just two settings, but I get what you're saying.
The thing of it is, Tarantino can pull it off because he writes such fantastic dialogue.
Exactly.
That, the acting
of it.
So
I almost think Tarantino is sort of like a playwright, like a stage drama, dialogue writer. I'd love to see a stage production of Reservoir Dogs. I think it could be done.
It could be done.
Me too.
It could be done, and that would be amazing
too.
I'd admire something like that.
But I gotta say, it would be a real shame if we don't get more version. I mean, if this story doesn't continue. So I really hope this sells well, because I'm excited to read the next part. So,
you know, for an artist, for a book like this, it has to be someone who's I think almost from our era, you know, like Ron Garney or someone who's done the big books, but I can also work in this, you know, military, whatever you want to call it, military sci-fi genre. I think that would be really amazing. I don't want to collaborate with someone who's, number one, not going to, you know, meet the deadlines, and number two, not meet the vision that I've presented here. So,
Well, that goes to show. So if they ever want to make it into a movie, how willing are you to sell off because they're going to change it. They're going to want to change stuff, take things out. Yeah. But would you be like, go ahead, take it, do your vision? Or would you stick to, I want to be involved and keep my characters what I am?
I think you understand what I mean when I say this. Either it has to be someone who's just like a refined and reputable filmmaker of maybe of the highest caliber, or just this trashy, Z grade,
yes. Yes,
like straight to Crackle, you know, filmmaker. Like, I don't want anything in between. You know, it either has to be like a classy, fantastic epic, or just
back to the '80s, no CGI.
Yeah, exactly. That, and I don't know if anyone would go along with that, because that really would be a stipulation. Like, Tom Savini would have to oversee special effects. Like,
perfect.
If Tom Savini isn't doing it, then I don't, you know, is it doing the special effects, and it's off, you know.
Or George Miller directing it.
Yeah, exactly.
His touch of the Road Warrior on it would be nice.
Exactly. I mean,
he's a little old, but.
Mad Max Fury Road is only 6 years, 7 years old.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, but I, you know, I'm talking the original Mad Max, the Road Warrior, which is, you know, I'm visioning Road Warrior.
Yeah.
Touches to this movie. Yeah. So good.
Yeah, that one had a huge impact. You can feel that in every, there's a nod to Road Warrior in that RV scene where they're trying to escape the mercenaries that are hot on their tail, and everyone's drone jamming, and they're just down to, you know, rifles and handguns trying to survive.
Yeah.
So
that's the sense I got out of it.
Yeah, no, it's you can recognize the movies I'm paying tribute to, but I'm always taking it and trying my best to push it just a little further than the original source, you know, so that you're left with this feeling, whoa, that, you know, where did that come from? That was wild.
Yeah.
That's the goal. And if I can do that and take people's breath away for a moment, and dazzle them and make them smile, to me, that's what it's all about.
So now, do you, in your class, do you give your students your book? I'm not going to say ask for their critique, but do you give your students your book?
Well, it's funny. I wrote this novel in chapters during a semester several years ago now. And that's how I started. Like, I started every week, you know, 15-week semester, I would bring in like a 2,000-word, 3,000-word chapter. And I did it not as a way to, like, you know, force them to read my novel, but to show them the practicality, the discipline, the energy that's required to get momentum on a project like this. Because, you know, creative writing in the at the university level is so strange, because you work on little stories and little poems, mm-hmm. and you kind of craft them and you polish them. And, you know, I wanted to get down and dirty with the students and just show them, this is how you write a novel. This is how you try to make money. This is how you try to get published. And so I just whipped through like the first 15 chapters of the book with them. And what happened during that semester was amazing, because guess what? They attempted the same thing.
Nice. And
found success with their work. So in other words, okay, they didn't get a contract with a publisher like mine, but they've self-published, they've Kindled, they've put their work out there on Amazon, and they finished the novel that they always wanted.
That's awesome.
This isn't just one student. I'm talking like seven or eight out of that class of the initial class of 15.
Wow.
And the others publish their short fiction or their poems. And so, you know, I just wanted to light a fire under them. And I felt like it was the way to do it. It felt like it was the right time. It was just before COVID. So we were still meeting in person, and, you know, I just sit and walk into the class and just read the next chapter, and they'd listen to it. They'd give us some feedback, but it wasn't the point. I wasn't trying to get their feedback. I wasn't trying to browbeat them into writing sci-fi or, you know, or anything like that. I was just saying, this is the momentum that you need. And they joined me in that effort. And it was just the most rewarding experience I've had as a professor, is watching them publish their work. You know,
that's awesome.
That does sound awesome.
A class together.
So speaking of the writing process, when you're writing this thing, do you kind of know, like, this is how it starts, this is what roughly how the middle goes, this is the end? Do you have it kind of outlined, or is this stream of conscious? Does it just kind of keep coming out of you?
Well, you know, honestly, it's a little bit of both. Now, it's true that I have the set pieces in mind, but how I get there is, you know, often changes. And when you write for such a sustained way, your characters will do things that you don't like. Why is he or she, they doing this right now? Like, what's happening?
Yeah.
And you just write your way through it, and you're just like, oh, that's why. You know, it's almost like the characters are showing you how to, you know, to do the book, to write the book. And that's very strange. And again, metaphysical, which I don't really believe in, but I don't want to say spiritual, but it's something is happening where the characters, if you've written them hard enough and long enough, they'll start showing you the path.
Yeah.
You'll be like, no, we're supposed to go this way. And they're like, no, we're not going. In order for us to get there, we have to do this other thing first. And so I'm like, oh, okay.
Has the character ever told you, I'm going this way, and you, the author, said, nope, it's got to go this way?
No, I've never, because it's unrewarding. If you push a character to a place that they don't feel like they don't belong, that they don't belong in, you start to see the shape of the of the words, it starts to clang. It's like a dissonant note on a guitar, a dissonant chord on a guitar. You know, you don't have it fretted. You don't have your hand fretting the strings just right. That's what it's like. And so I've just learned to, you know, if they want to blow up this building, or they want to fight this guy, that's fine. Let's because they know better than I do. And if you overthink it, if you get too up in your head and clinical, then you get a really boring postmodern, you know, or formulaic stories that nobody cares about, wants to read. And I don't want to do that. There's enough boring books out there. I want to do stuff that's different and that's character driven, but also, you know, action packed.
So it seems like the influence of graphic novels has kind of hit, you know, yep, it's not a graphic novel, but it is that short and sweet. And was there influence for Lush? Was that partially you or partially a bunch of people put together or what?
No, I mean, here, it's those Jack Kirby comics. He is all about kinetic action in the Marvel universe before it was called that. You know, he created all these concepts and characters, and Lash is she's in that lineage of those characters that Jack Kirby created, which is why the book is dedicated to Jack Kirby. You know, I understand, yes, he's a graphic novelist, he's a comic book artist, but it's not just visually what he did, it's in terms of storytelling. I mean, he had a headlong momentum that there's never a boring Jack Kirby book. Like, I've got, you know, hundreds of them here behind
you back there.
You pick one up, you're not going to get bored. It's a guaranteed anti-boredom. It's a, you know, it's a boredom. It'll cure your boredom if you read a Jack Kirby comic. And that's what I wanted to do with Hammer of the Dogs and with Lash, because Lash is, in some ways, if Commandy is the last boy on Earth, Lash is the last girl on Earth.
Okay.
You know, and she harkens back to this thing that we've kind of lost track of too, you know, the tomboy, the mm-hmm. girl that was tough and that could outshoot you, outfight you, outfish you, outdo every, you know, just take you on a ride. And you know, I miss that person, those women. Like, I don't see them anymore. Now everything's all complicated and political and you know, social media massaged, and I wanted to find this person again, and I had to go writing
to, to
reconnect.
And I should have explained it, I guess, more like anybody in your life that you put into this character.
Oh yeah, kids I grew up with. Kids I grew up with.
Okay, now specific.
Classmates, you know,
okay.
From middle school, high school, and who I lost track of, you know, because when I went to college, it changes your whole social environment. Your social connections become, you know, they're changed forever, because then you're hanging out with people who get degrees, and then they go on, they want to get a master's degree, and then they want to get a PhD, and then, you know, it just you find yourself out of touch.
Yeah.
Well, and let's touch on that. PhD in creative writing.
I'm a doctor.
A doctor of writing.
Now, I mean, I'd like to claim myself as a doctor of love, but that I haven't gone to college for. So as I was saying to him, I'm like, is this common to get a PhD in writing?
It might be too common. I mean, here's the thing. In the 90s, there were like 10 creative writing PhD programs in the country, like in the 90s, which, you know, it was not a lot, but I think today there's like, you know, nearly 100.
Okay. So
it's just really, you know, metastasized and gotten out of control. And I'm not sure it's made anything better in terms of writing or books. You know, it worked for me because I could just hang out in school and, you know, I hung out long enough, they gave me a PhD diploma. Because they couldn't get rid of me. Because, you know, I just love reading and I love writing. So the library, a university library, is the perfect place for me to sit down. Granted, I was, you know, doing strange things like interlibrary loaning, you know, European adult comics from, you know, facilities in France and stuff like that. But, you know, why not? Let's try it out.
Exactly. Why not?
Yeah, right. Right. You never know. You never know what might inspire you.
So you have definitely touched on the comic books. Was there book authors that you clung to as a child?
As a kid, I never really read a book until I got into college, you know.
Wow. Like, oh, wow. And then said, my life.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah, that's amazing.
Well, I always associated books with, like, broccoli. Like, they were very cruciferous. They were supposed to make you better and make you think about the world and get you on board with some kind of weird agenda. And I didn't like it, you know. Even books with books that offered an ideology that I more or less agreed with, they always seemed a little bit didactic, and they became less fun the older I got. And then to the point where, you know, if you're reading something like James Joyce's Ulysses, you're like, why? This is no story here. What am I doing? Why am I studying this?
Definition of didactic.
Fuck that.
Hyper instructive, meant to, you know, generate moral, you know, I think it's moral betterment.
It's great to be sitting with a writer because I just read the word cruciferous within the past week or two, and I had no idea. You know, when you see a word and you have no idea how to read it, so you just kind of, it sounds a little bit like this, and you just scan over it. Now I know how to say it.
Yeah, it was like fiber or something. It's what the books tasted like. And then, you know, when I got into college, I started to get into things that were, you know, different, like Ray Carver, for example, writers who were attempting to do something a little bit different. But science fiction fantasy has kind of always been my go-to in terms of writers. But I like all the greats, you know, Cormac McCarthy, if you've read or seen the movie No Country for Old Men.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Great action flick. And but you know, now, I love it.
There's been a big discussion about Old Country for Men.
Yeah,
that it's people either get it or don't get it as a masterpiece, and they see the movie, they read the book, they say, "I don't get it." And others read it like, "Then you don't get it, but it's amazing, it's perfect."
Yeah,
obviously you're a fan of it.
Yes, I am.
How do you explain it to be a perfect? I've never read the book. Obviously, I've seen the movie.
Obviously.
I don't read many books, so you're one of very few that I've read.
Yeah. I don't think it's a perfect book, but I do think it's a hell of a lot of fun, and it's certainly better than his previous novels, which were more difficult. You know, he wrote about characters who were impossible to identify with or love. You know, he'd write about, like, I don't know, child molesters and just, you know, wife beaters and really tough people who were, you know, they're tough to get along with, tough to understand. He was always difficult that way as a younger writer. And as he got older, he kind of embraced the thriller. I don't know if you've read The Road, for instance, or seen the movie The Road, a post-apocalyptic adventure. And
Robert Patterson and Guy Pearce, I think, are in the movie.
Well, I don't know. Is it? I can't remember now.
No, it's...
I haven't seen the movie.
Vito Martinson.
That's it.
I'm mixing it up with another apocalypse movie. Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so those books, when he got older, he seemed to embrace genre fiction. And I thought that was very interesting. And those are the books that I really took to heart and really cherish. Mm-hmm. No Country for Old Men, The Road. I love I love books that embrace genre but kind of try to do something different with it and don't necessarily stick to the same boring formula, because we've all read those books. You know, you used to see them at Albertsons or Vaughn's or Smith, the grocery store Western. You know, you'd pick it up and you're like, okay, I'm gonna read this and it's gonna satisfy my needs, whatever. You know, you read a Western. I read the Western, but it doesn't, after you're done, you're like, well, why did I just read that? I don't remember anything about it. It read like a million other Westerns.
Yeah.
Sure.
So for me, it's all about finding a strong writer like Elmore Leonard, who takes that, embraces the category of writing, but doesn't follow the rules.
So, I've read a few of his books.
Well, what is it? Justified is based on one of his stories.
One of his stories. Yeah.
Oh.
And Jackie Brown's based off of Rum Punch.
Yes.
And yeah. Get Shorty, things like
yes.
that.
Yes. Yes. And so he's just a fantastic writer.
Not great characters, to your point. They're not
heroes,
they're just real characters.
Yeah, and that's something I admire about Elmore Leonard. And I love Charles Williford, a Florida crime writer, who I guess his most famous book is probably Miami Blues with Alec Baldwin and
Well, sure.
Jennifer Jason Leigh. Great film. And I just like books that are accessible but not predictable.
Okay. Any new writers that have come out lately that you kind of see that similarity in? Besides yourself?
I think that answer spoke for itself.
All right. So back to
all my favorite authors are dead. So
still searching for a new one.
But
I'm kind of a baby boomer trapped in a Gen X body. You know, I like the old stuff.
So that makes it easy to, like, you don't have to worry about getting captured by something else. Everybody you like is dead. So
yeah,
you're good. Everything you like has already been made.
Although George Lucas is still alive. I mean,
and maybe there'll be a Howard the Duck too.
Oh, I would.
Wasn't there a Howard the Duck too? No. Oh, I thought there was.
Now there was a teaser of one of the movies at the end where they had Howard the Duck, but the way the comic book and the movie are completely different.
Yes.
He made the comic book more comical, and he was a dirty old duck.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Cigar smoking duck. I mean, obviously you probably read the novels of those
yes.
back in the day. And there was the teaser, and you've got nice.
I had it out for you.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
There's a real Howard the Duck.
Nice.
I had that as a kid. Yes. Yes.
Yes, the sword and the cigar would both be, removed if they made a Netflix series.
Right. Right.
So at the end of, I don't remember which movie it was where they, after the credits, they put, like the glass broke and Howard the Duck was there. And I was so excited that they're finally going to do Howard the Duck the right way. And then it just vanished. I don't know what happened to it.
Yeah. It was disappointing. I believe it was Guardians of the Galaxy that
you could be right.
It was the end trailer, but I mean, how are they going to do it? I mean, how would you do Howard? I mean, it's impossible. It's so politically incorrect and so far
it is. Out
there and psychedelic inspired, and it's from a different era. When again, this is what I was going back to, which is, the '80s is a time, I believe, of bright darkness. So things were kind of, gritty and weird and full of sorcery and dark sci-fi like Blade Runner and Dune and things like that. But there was also this brightness to it. Like it didn't all look the same. It wasn't all like moody. There was a range, a palette, if you will, a full spectrum of colors and cinematography. And even in the writing, like there was tones, there were different moments, different scenes. And it wasn't that they were inconsistent or tonally, whacked. It was just that, writers understood that you had to have different emotional moments through a story. Sure. And today, I think that's all been lost. Everything's just gray, blue, black, and it's all done because of CGI so that they can more easily, do their effects and make you not notice how bad they are. I like the old way of doing things, that kind of energy, that kind of style, that kind of attitude, that kind of aggression, the liberation of it, being able to, smoke a cigarette and carry a sword and, not have it be a big deal.
Right.
We've made everything so sanitized. And it doesn't help that everything's been corporatized. Disney owns everything. Warner Brothers owns everything. It's just a terrible moment. And today's writers don't care about this kind of stuff. They don't care about emotional moments. They want to they have this thing they want to say, and they're going to just beat you with it for 2.5 hours. And this is true even of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the DCU. Sure. It's kind of all the same. Like, they're so unabashed in their plagiarism of each other. I think the Flash movie is like a multiverse
thing. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I've kind of given up.
We've given up, and yeah. I just think there's a chance and an opportunity to offer something that's a little different. If we just take a step back and look at what worked back then, we'll find different ways of telling new stories, because right now it's all the same slop, the same corporate goulash, and I'm sick of it. And I had to react. I had to like present something that was full throttle fun and, you know, something that you couldn't put down. You had just wanted to see what was going to blow up next.
What's going to happen next.
Yeah. Right.
Well, and I appreciate low budget movies for the fact of, you know, people watch it and say, I could tell that's fake. But I look at it and say, but they only had $1 million to do all these special effects back in the day. So I appreciate the way they did it on film then. And that's what I love about old movies and old 80s movies.
You know, yes. But, you know, I guess I was just a silly, naive kid, but I believed everything I saw. Like, I didn't know what a space alien ripping apart a human body would look like. I just knew that, you know, like, maybe it looks like that. I have no idea.
Right.
You know?
Right. Right. No, you're right.
And today, with all the CGI, it still looks like crap. It looks like a video game. And so I don't know. I'm not sure we've really improved in terms of visual effects. I mean, I know a few people in visual effects and, you know, they get mad at me, but I'm just like, this doesn't look good. I mean, go back, you know, or mix them up or something. And, you know, let's go back to blood bags
and Tom Severo.
I'm yes.
saying his name wrong. I mean, he was the master of
Savini,
low
yeah.
budget Savini. I'm sorry. I apologize, Tom.
Tom Savini.
Tom Savini. He's the master. He was a legend, and he still is, of what he could create for low budget horror, yes. gore.
Yes.
And, bring that back.
There's a ton of gore in this book. But, you know, gore for me is different than torture. Like, I don't like torture movies or torture sure. narratives. They freak me out. But as far as, like, you know, genetically modified swarming flamingos exploding in the air. Yeah, I totally, because it has no bearing on reality, you know.
Yeah.
And that's why I loved that stuff as a kid. I loved gory movies. I loved even slasher movies. I totally enjoyed. What got weird is in the 90s or early 2000s was the whole torture horror movie that seemed to go way out of control.
Torture porn.
Torture porn?
Torture porn movies. I didn't like that as yeah. much. They weren't my jam, but some people like them, and that's great. But for me, it's always about, like, you know, the fantastic, the supernatural. You know, to me, Jason and Michael Myers, they weren't really real. They were like phantasms or
yeah. something. So which is your go-to franchise of horror?
The go-to, like, if I'm like my comfort
yeah, like between Jason or Michael or Freddy or
I mean, I don't know, it's hard to beat the first Halloween, but I also like, I'm not gonna lie to you, when Jason fights the psychic girl and whatever Friday the 13th that is, that's so hilarious. I mean, it's like it's like Carrie versus sure. Jason or something.
Yeah.
It made no sense, but I will sit down with it and enjoy it. The remake of The Blob from the 80s, I really like for some reason. I don't know why. It's just, it's gross.
Right. You don't have to have a reason why. I don't think.
Dawn of the Dead. I mean, something about being trapped in the mall with zombies is so.
That's one of my top horror movies ever is Dawn of the Dead.
I just can't. I can't get over it. Like, if I'm depressed, if I put that on, I'm ready to live life again. You know, which makes no sense.
So speaking of all these movies, who plays Lash when this thing is a movie? Have you ever stopped to think who would be some of the actors in this thing?
Yeah, but by the time by the time they get around to looking at considering it, I mean, I don't know. I like the. What is it? They'd all have to lift weights, though. I mean, like Jenny Ortega, I think, would be great.
Wow.
That's exactly who
exactly
I said.
Who he said. He did.
Before we came.
Yeah.
That's exactly who I was thinking of.
They'd have to hit the gym really,
yeah.
really hard, you know, to do a push-up.
And that's what I said. I said she'd have to buff up
right.
a little bit.
Right.
She could do it.
You'd have to have Ronda Rousey, but she's too old.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure there's younger fighters. I just don't. Yeah. I don't know them too. I don't watch a lot of that YA stuff, but I'm sure there's the actor in the Blue Beetle.
I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah,
yet.
I haven't either.
Bruna something. I don't know. I can't remember their names, but there's so many. I mean, who's the one that was in West Side Story? Help me out.
Mm. Oh.
Snow White. She's going to be in Snow White.
I don't know her name.
That actor is amazing.
I don't know her name.
West Side Story was amazing.
Let me help you out a little bit. When you're looking to cast Richter and Prof, you got. Yeah. I mean, I know we're awesome. Too old, but we'll. Yeah. You can make us
a makeup up and makeup.
Yeah,
yeah. No CGI.
In my mind, I was thinking of Michelle Rodriguez as I'm writing Hammer of the Dogs. You know, from Girl Fight, that era. You know,
yeah,
sure. Years ago. But the thing with casting is, you know. I had this image of Michelle Rodriguez, but then as I started writing the character, this other face, it was weird. This other person emerged. Now I don't know who that is. So anything I do, anything I suggest is just an approximation.
You yeah,
know? Absolutely. Yeah.
But you know, for me, it was really important to make the character Lash mixed race, you know, that is Hispanic and white. I never really found a character like that, that really satisfied, you know, the kind of like whatever representational, I don't know, urge needs and that I had, you know, like the closest that the character who's I most identified with in so many ways was Ralph Macchio in The Karate Kid. He came closest to kind of, you know, representing my experience of kind of being caught between two worlds.
Yeah. You know,
the Anglo side and then the ethnic background. So I really was trying to create a character who was different in so many ways and couldn't be really pigeonholed or placed in a category. And that was super important as I was writing this character, because here at the university I teach at, University of Nevada, Las Vegas, you know, we have the most diverse student body. Like the kids come from, you know, everywhere, you know, I get Mexican Americans, Filipino Americans, you know, just everybody is, and then they're all mixed together, and it's incredible. So I wanted to like pay tribute to my own experience and to the experience of my students with Lash, who doesn't really fit conveniently into a box. And that's why they speak Spanish and Spanglish throughout the book, because that was my experience, you know, growing up. And there's really only like, the way I wrote it, there's really only like maybe two we would call Anglo or white characters. But, you know, Richter is sort of nebulous too in his ethnicity. You can't really get a read on him. He's sort of like Johnny Depp. Is he a pirate? Is he just a dark, you know, phantasm? What is going on here? And then gradually he becomes more human and you realize he's just as compromised as everybody, as we all are. So nice. That was the goal there.
So going back to the University of Las Vegas, which is the book is set in. I don't know if we mentioned that or not.
But the book's set in Las Vegas?
Yeah.
Well, we mentioned a lot of Luxor.
Which I was a huge fan back in the day of the Running Rebels. I watched a lot. I don't know how long you've been teaching there.
Oh, and I've only been a professor here since 2016. So
not that long. Yeah. And was there a graphic novel department when you started?
No, no one taught the graphic novel. No one taught, you know, no one wants to teach the graphic novel. It's too difficult, and it's so far outside, you know, the mainstream academic experience. And
did you bring it up? Did you bring it on to the campus?
I did.
Well, that's awesome. How was that journey?
Well, it was wonderful. I mean, it's funny because when you enter into a English PhD program, it's just assumed, it's understood that you're going to study like what you're supposed to study, you know, the romantic masterpieces, the you know, the works of realism in American fiction, you know, you're going to study a British lit from, you know, Shakespeare to Jane Austen to, you know, George Orwell, but there's never this moment where you can say, hey, this stuff is fun. Am I allowed to read it and write about it?
Yeah. Like
fun is just, and pleasure is so removed from the, you know, the humanities and English departments in particular, that, you know, it's just, people don't even think to raise their hand and say, you know, hey, let's make something fun here.
Sure.
And so the novel Hammer of the Dogs is my attempt to kind of like introduce that graphic novel aesthetic or energy or pleasure into, you know, literary prose. And I don't want to say that graphic novels or comics are always art. Like, there's a lot of junk like everything else.
Right.
But there are some works within that medium that are just undeniable. You know, Watchmen is a masterpiece. You know, Dark Knight Returns by Frank Miller is a masterpiece. You know, Mouse.
Sin City.
Sin City is a masterpiece. You know, there's these books that you read them and you're changed. You know, I would say The Crow by James O'Barr is a masterpiece. And the movie's good too, but the book is even better, the comic. And so for me, it's about trying to introduce things that are fun to students so that they'll want to become English majors. They'll want to pursue their degrees. They'll want to write about these things, think about these things, and think more deeply about what the whole enterprise involves. To me, you know, I'm not teaching comic books so that my students will be cool at dinner parties or, you know, have something interesting to talk about at the bar. Like, I'm doing this so that they'll explore like their own identities, their own, you know, paths, their own heroic journeys, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
Because everything that I value now as an adult is stuff that I learned from comics. You know, like, you know, these are aspirational models to a degree. You know, the journey of Conan the Barbarian to King Conan, there's a huge lesson in there, which is that if you stick to you know, a project like, you know, power or you know, leadership, you if you stick with it, you are rewarded. And if you play it smart, make good decisions, and honor your friends and family, you can achieve these things. To me, there's a lesson there. This is what I want my students to think about. You know, you can't always be like the Crow, you know, wasting everybody and burning everything down. I mean, that leads to what the end of the Crow is, which is a suicide mission.
Yeah.
You know, it's in the book.
I mean, sure. I know it, but I've never read it.
You're left on that final page of The Crow wondering, was he dead all along, or was he what was the point of this? Did he do this simply to reunite with his dead fiance? Why did we go on this journey? So I want my students to think about these things.
Yeah. Okay.
Because if you don't think about your life as a story, you turn into like a chaos monster. And I think that's kind of like the spiritual crisis we're suffering at the moment as a country, with you know, mass shootings and just terrible behavior and the crime rampant and spreading everywhere. I mean, we've lost the story. So people see no hope in their lives because they can't see the beats. They don't see the set pieces. They don't have any real useful or rewarding pleasure. The pleasures they do know are like ridiculous and destructive.
Yeah.
I guess that's the other thing that I'm trying to get my students to think about, which is that, you know, to seek pleasure in things that make them better and make them stronger, not these kinds of, you know, heroin is pleasurable, but, you know, nobody should shoot it. It's
because it's destructive.
Right.
Yeah.
But Howard the Duck is better than heroin.
Love that we keep going back to Howard the Duck.
if you know how to approach it right, you know, for me. Because I love thinking about these things, you know, other dimensions. I love thinking about Howard's plight, you know, that famous line from the comic book, trapped in a world he never made. I mean, that's sort of the existential human condition. We're all caught in these existences that we had no decision in, you know.
Yeah.
So now what are we going to do? How are we going to do this?
And I feel like, did I read almost that exact line somewhere in the book?
Yes.
I was going to say, I feel like that was... But I don't know who said it or
fun a different way,
but... yeah
exactly, that's my
homage,
tip of the hat. Yeah, it's my my nod to Howard the Duck. And you know, it seems like a silly throwaway piece of pop culture, but if you just examine it, it's a deep and thoughtful story. And that's why I disagree with this idea that the 80s were this surface, superficial. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of the 80s that was trash and nonsense and ridiculous, but there was also all these great things that, you know, we're wearing the shirts and the gear from you know, and we do that for a reason, because the message and the mythology of it is enduring.
Comic book
You went back to the 70s.
Yes.
60s.
Now, Howard the Duck, I thought it was from the late 70s. Am I wrong?
No, no, it's the early 80s.
Okay, it's the comic book is?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. The comic is from the 70s. The movie's from the early 80s, yeah. Yes. It goes all the way back, really. The idea for Howard goes back to the, you know, counterculture. And he's sort of like a really edgy countercultural take on, you know, Daffy Duck or whatever.
Sure, right. Sure.
Nice. You know, we're going to get him smoking cigars and wielding swords and having all kinds of crazy journeys. You're running for president, you know, saving the president from assassination, et cetera. It takes you on a tour of the 70s. Nice. The comic book does. It's unforgettable.
And I think every child experiments with comic books at some point. And I was never into the Spider-Mans and Supermans and Batman. My brother was, but Howard the Duck was one of them that I would buy. Sergeant Rock was a big one for me when I was a kid. He was huge. Black Panther was a big one for me. Where am I going with this? I don't know.
I don't know.
Let's also think about those icons of popular culture, and then think about just from the other, whatever you want to call it, gender. Okay. Strawberry Shortcake, which I reference in the book.
Yeah.
Rainbow Bright. My Little Pony, all the stuff that the three of us probably, you know, were like, whatever, but that stuff was powerful. Gem and the Holograms.
It was powerful, yes.
Yeah.
She-Ra, Princess of Power. We didn't watch that stuff, but you know, I've got all those theme songs in my head, and yeah. I know what the toys look like. I didn't own any of the toys, but I saw the commercials on TV.
Over and over.
These are powerful images that, you know, that girls enjoyed and loved and grew up with, and now... You know, it's almost like that stuff is like bad or something, or we have to like make it all super feminist or something. It doesn't. Yeah. It offered us pleasure when we were young, and I think we're forgetting that, and we're having to, you know, the Barbie movie. I think a great example is like it's so successful because people are so hungry for that stuff.
Yeah,
and it brings it back to what we're talking about. I think their childhood and their memories of just having clean fun or just.
Yes.
Fun of no thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But I will say it was thoughtless fun, but if you looked at it, even just if you scratched it a little bit, you'd find like layers of stuff in there. Like the Evel Knievel doll that I grew up with, you know, like that is a doll.
Favorite toy ever.
That's a doll that is tapped into the whole 70s mythology of, you know, masculinity and showmanship. And daredevilry, and you know, that's a whole world in and of itself. And I think that we need to go back to that a little bit and consider why those things were so powerful. Because today we have nothing like it. It's all YouTubed and social media massaged and digitally, you know, polished. And it doesn't hit the same way. And if we just take a step back and look at what worked and bring it to bear on with all this technology, we can create new and exciting stories and characters, but nobody seems willing to do it. So I'm throwing Hammer of the Dogs down.
You're doing it.
I was going to say, you certainly have. And I hope everybody goes out there and buys it. And I'm going to tell you for you and for us, because I feel a little selfish, because I feel like when this thing is the next Hunger Games, we have this fancy copy here that probably not a lot of people have. And
yeah, you get the sensor. I don't know why they put that sticker on her. Like, I know why they put the sticker on her like that. But anyway, I'm going to send you guys some the final version, which is without the sticker blocking the view.
Awesome.
The good view. Which would be amazing. We do appreciate that. We'd love if you sign it and we will put it out.
Oh, right, yeah, here. Absolutely.
Right here, next to absolutely. Our other author.
Another author. Yeah, that would be awesome. Yeah,
one other author.
Yeah, we don't talk with a lot of authors. I don't think people think we're smart enough to talk with authors, but I think we're not. Okay. I was about to say we proved ourselves, but
we're not smart enough to talk to a PhD, but we do anyways.
Yeah. With Dr. King. Yeah, I like it next to that liquor bottle. Is that
you bet.
That's
a nice bottle of vodka with a message that runs by. This was some friends of ours when we started this thing.
Great.
So
I don't know
if it's working. Oh, there you go. It takes a second.
Oh, look at that. Okay.
Yeah. It says something.
It says our name.
Yeah. So we have
it was a gift. Congrats on starting the podcast. And it
says, oh great.
dipples in the beer. Oh, it shut off. I don't know.
Did already, yeah.
Maybe the battery. Oh, there it is.
The battery's running out.
There we go. Yes. Oh, that's nice.
It's pretty freaking cool.
Yeah, I like that.
We should. Well, and it's funny because when we started this thing and when we got that bottle 5 or 10 episodes in, we never thought we'd be talking to, you know, authors and PhDs and all this good stuff. We're thrilled and honored that you wanted to come and talk to us about your book, because we're lucky enough to get to read it, and it's great. And I hope everybody does.
Yes. And we're not, I don't think we're bullshitting by saying we really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
and
no.
It kept my interest, and I don't read a lot of books. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you for reading it.
Yeah.
So I did want to touch on one thing, because we touched on the Hunger Games before.
Oh, yes.
You seem sour at it. But so I was going to ask you, because I love the movie, and I don't know if you ever saw it, Battle Royale.
Yes.
Oh, you do know that movie?
Okay. That's the book. Well, I read the book in the 90s when the first translation that came out, and you know, I found it in Barnes & Noble. I was like, what is this? This looks deadly. This looks dangerous.
Right.
And then I read the book, and it was a total nightmare adventure saga, and I couldn't stop reading it. And I wanted to bring Hammer of the Dogs more into the, I wanted to bring YA dystopian fiction more into that direction than, you know, Hunger Games, as wonderful as it is, and many people find it to be so. I prefer Battle Royale. I like that harder,
yes,
darker. But at the same time, it's a story that, when you read through it, it's not nihilistic. It's not, there is a moral center to it. It's just, it's kind of warning us about what, you know, what could lie ahead if we let it, you know, which is this voyeuristic tech driven, you know, nightmare that everyone seems blindly headed toward. And, I don't like it, but I love reading a book like that. It makes me think and takes me on a dark thrill ride.
Yeah.
That's what I love. Well, with Battle Royale, and yes, the movie, well, there's two films really,
right?
Live action. And then the animated feature.
Oh, I don't know the animated. I know there's a Battle Royale and a Battle Royale too, which I've got both.
Yes. But, there's also a manga.
Okay.
Yeah. But it was a novel first.
I've not read it, but.
It doesn't matter what format you put it in. It's sure. The same story I see, what I've found. But it's so powerful, and so it changed, I believe, dystopian YA fiction. Kids in the 90s found it. It was a cult sensation. And that the sensation that grew, the audience that grew around that book was more natural and organic, I feel, in many ways, than the Hunger Games phenomenon, which seemed astroturfed by... A rip off
of the Hunger of
Battle. Yeah, plus it had a lot of marketing behind it. Like I was encountering Hunger Games merchandise and just walking through the mall. Like you'd look through in a window of a shop, like what was it, Hot Topic or something?
Sure.
And they'd be like, Hunger Games. I'm like, what is Hunger Games? Like, yeah. And it worked. It was like, what's Hunger Games? I got to find out what this is. It had a multi-million dollar campaign budget. Marketing behind it, and but that was not the case with Battle Royale. That was more of an organic,
yes.
So I have a lot more respect for that franchise, whatever you want to call it, IP or whatever. But I do think that I would love to teach Battle Royale
in
my classroom, but again, you know, there have to be a lot of trigger warnings and all
that. there would be, yes.
It's insanely violent. But Hammer of the Dogs, the end there with the genetically modified flamingo swarm massacre, that's my way of, like, you know, tipping my hat to Battle Royale, the Japanese novel.
Perfect.
Nice.
One of my favorites.
Nice. I've come out of this with, like, so much stuff I have to watch, so, because I am not the connoisseur like this guy is. I'm on the fringes, so I'm like, wow. I did see Howard the Duck when I was a kid. But,
yeah. Okay,
but I don't remember it, so I will be watching again. And this Battle Royale, I definitely have to check out.
Yeah, Secret of Nim was a great film that I loved growing up. Heavy Metal, the animated.
Yeah.
Fire and Ice, the animated Ralph Bakshi film. These are all these Watership Down, which I saw on TV and it freaked me out. these are all. touchstones in my life and many other lives. I just think we got to go back and start making gritty, bright yet gritty stories like that.
Yeah.
And get rid of this Pixar crap, because it's soft. Yeah. It's too soft. It's fluffy.
Amen to that.
Well, and that's why I love Battle Royale, because it touched on the, wait, these are kids. You can't do that to kids.
Right.
And then they did.
Yeah.
But because you can do it, it would happen to them. So I'm with you on the grittiness.
The book you guys, I'm sure you read it as kids. I read it as a kid. The Long Walk by Stephen King. It's that murder, death march, dystopian novel where the high school kids, they compete on a reality TV show. This is written in the 70s, on a reality show to keep walking until they stop. And if they stop, they're shot by government troops. So, and whoever is left standing gets like $1 million at the end of the walk.
No, I did not read it. Wow.
You guys got to find that book.
I was going to say, I have a bunch of Stephen King on my bookshelves at home, and I don't even know if I've even heard of that.
It's a novella. It's a short novel. It was one
okay.
of the first. I think he wrote it. He might have written it under the Bachman name. And then there's, of course, there's a novel we're not allowed to talk about, or he refuses to let it be reprinted, which is Rage, which is like a school shooter novella.
Oh, wow.
Well, I believe that's in the Bachman books, but you have to get an early edition to read it.
Wow.
But my point is, like, this is the stuff I grew up reading as a 10-year-old. I think about what 10-year-olds are forced to watch today, and it's just like this.
Right.
You know, we're not preparing them for anything.
Reality.
It's just this fluffy garbage, and it all looks the same. It all looks like it's animated by the same, people.
Yeah.
I just want to see different stories out there and not be afraid to offer dreams and nightmares, because that's what life is about, unfortunately. Right.
Well, I think the other side of that is, as a author and as a playwright or as a storyteller in any form, as you were saying before, it just writes itself. So you go one direction, but culture is telling you, well, no, you can't say that anymore.
You see?
But that's where my story is telling me to go.
Right.
How do you fight that?
I just stopped caring,
Good.
And you have to. You can't,
the best answer ever.
I'm not writing for, the sensitivity I'm not writing so that to comfort people or to make everybody really, I want people to be thrilled and have a good time and smile.
Right.
But I'm not there to like coddle them and make them feel good about themselves. And it's going to be okay if we just believe in ourselves, and love each other. And, that's BS. That doesn't work. It's not real. And I think we're doing a disservice by pushing this message on kids, especially this, it's all corporate stuff that I feel like, that movie They Live, like I'm putting on those glasses.
Yes.
And then I take them off and then I put them back on. I see, oh my God, what are they really telling us here? Which is just consume garbage, eat garbage,
and obey.
Yeah. Just
now, funny story real quick is this month they are re-releasing that in theaters.
Yeah.
They Live. So you can see it in the big screen.
Yeah. I've got tickets. It's tomorrow night, right? I've got tickets.
For Is that tomorrow night already?
Yeah.
It's good tomorrow. For you.
Yeah, so I'm taking the family to see They Live.
That's awesome. It's a classic. It's an awesome, and I love John Carpenter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my sons love John Carpenter. They love that movie, The Thing.
Yeah.
Oh, one of the best horror movies ever.
Yeah, and all of those effects, and they get mad at me, like, "Shut up, Dad!" I'm like, "This is all before CGI. This, they had to build this stuff."
Exactly what I was saying before. Absolutely. You appreciate what they did.
And it freaked me out when I saw it as a child. And, I just think that's the stuff I grew up with, not Pixar, not DreamWorks, not, me, we have to go back to that. If this new generation is going to have a chance, they're just going to get brainwashed by this stuff. To me, it's super terrifying. I don't want to go on about it, but, I just think we need to find, other stories to tell, and not the same. They think they're telling different stories, but they're really not. These corporations—they're just telling the same soft, fluffy cotton candy crap. Yeah.
Between that and AI, we're fucked.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it already seems written by AI, doesn't it?
I was going to say, it's a result of AI already, isn't it?
I feel like every movie I've seen in the last 10 years has been AI generated.
Chat GPT wrote the script.
I mean, why? Why are you giving me this rehash? Sorry, yeah. I'm lecture rant done.
That's okay. I just wanted to ask about, so how many children do you have and what are their ages?
I've got two boys, 17 and 15, and they love John Carpenter and they love, but they're, you know, they're also hardcore gamers.
Right.
But I say that and they just played tennis in the Las Vegas heat for 2 hours, which is something I never did as a child. So I might be, you know, they're vast. They contain multitudes.
Yeah.
So they do a lot of different things.
Well, and I was going to say is, you know, cause my children are older and they gave me the roll in the eyes when I would show them these movies and they would, no, I don't want to watch it. And then 10 minutes in, they're glued and they love it. But then you see it later on, they reflect on it and they're like, hey, I watched what by themselves that you expose them to later. So it just comes around and it's a huge influence. And
they have this thing called flashback cinema, you know, like in the movie theater down the street. And I told my 15-year-old, hey, Goonies is playing. He's like, let's go.
Yes.
And I've seen Goonies maybe 500 times. I don't need to see it again. But if I can just sit in a theater with him and have, you know, watch him smile, listen to him crack jokes with me, and you know, it's totally worth it. And
if your teenager wants to hang out with you, you're doing it. It doesn't matter.
Right. I had to do it. Like I'm gonna go see Goonies. I'll see 1,000 more times with you if you'll let me.
Yeah.
I'm with you. Yeah. So but we're kind of touching it before about being in Las Vegas. We've had a filmmaker on from Vegas. We've had an actor and a filmmaker that we interviewed.
Yeah.
Who did
the movie Kindred.
Kindred.
Kindred. His name is Adrian Leon. He's a filmmaker out of Vegas.
Oh, okay.
And,
yeah.
And he filmed it there and produced it. So just a name to remember.
Well, didn't Mark Wahlberg move here or something? There was something. Mark Wahlberg was going to move to Vegas and start a movie production company. So I don't know. If that's going
That'd be incredible. It seems like a lot more movies are popping up in Vegas and they're going there to film them and independently just to get away from California and the bullshit that's there.
I can't believe there's anyone still there. I can't believe there isn't at this moment a giant Las Vegas film push because California's got so many, you know, challenges.
Yeah.
Right.
I got to meet Gary Nelson, the director of The Black Hole from the late 70s.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is a film that I reference in the It was a science fiction film that scared the hell out of me. And Gary Nelson was a director. He lived here until until he died last year.
Okay. And I got to
interview him for a magazine here in town and chat about that movie and the others that he did, like Freaky Friday. And
he had a heck of a career. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Black Hole was a great movie. I think back to your point, it could have been, they could have cut out some areas.
Yes.
Made it a better movie.
I agree.
Right. I mean, it kind of dragged and it was a little, but it was a good movie.
It's unforgettable if you saw it as a kid, like Maximilian, the red robot with the whirring blade was super scary. And that's where I got the idea for the Red Angels. You know, they're kind of like flying red robots. So for me, a movie like The Black Hole, it was not a box office smash. It might have been a critical and commercial failure, but I loved it, and that's all that matters, you know.
right.
I agree. Yeah. There's so many movies I love and people around me hate, but I don't care.
Like me?
Like you.
Yeah. Only John
Wick. Critical, hated and whatever, and I'm like, I fucking love this movie. And The Black Hole had an impact. I mean, I think it was a lot of buildup to it when it came out because
it was hyped.
It was so hyped, special effects, and it was great special effects for the time. But
yeah, again, it was a Disney movie. They had they had a lot of marketing money to burn, and they wanted their own Star Wars. They got this weird, bizarre, dark space western instead that didn't really. They didn't have a pretty Luke Skywalker, or like a pirate Han Solo. They had these old actors from westerns like Ernest Borgnine.
so they brought in classic actors, but it didn't translate to the younger crowd. Yeah, I'm with you.
I mean, I remember watching it as a kid going, these guys are old, but it's kind of cool. I'm going to keep watching.
Right, right. Because everything around it was cool. Yeah. And then they threw in an alien or a android, you know, just to be
robot.
Robot, just to be whatever.
Yeah, R2-D2 knockoff. And I guess they figured Roy Scheider was, you know, he carried Jaws. Why can't these old guys carry the black hole? So they didn't have like a handsome space warrior and princess.
And I love Roy Scheider. I love his movies. Most of his movies.
Oh no, I will get down with Blue Thunder. I mean, I love.
Yes, that's a great movie.
Which is weird because I hate helicopters when they fly over my house and they spotlight me.
Sure when they spotlight me. But that was a badass movie when it came out.
It was amazing. And but again, not a movie that anyone remembers or celebrated, but to me it was super, super important. And I loved every, you know, Battlestar Galactica on TV. I loved everything cheesy and weird. Knight Rider, I loved all that stuff. Yeah. The cheesier the better. And
and just this weekend I bought Red Sonja.
Yes,
I just bought that this weekend. I've not seen it since the 80s.
You know, I think Arnold still makes fun of it today. Like he just thinks it's just garbage. But to me, it was, he's in the movie, so it's great.
Yeah, right? Right?
Why are you complaining? You're in this film where you've got a sword, a loincloth,
right? And
clobbering dragons. I mean, what is the problem? This is the dream.
You're living the dream.
This is the dream.
The never-ending story, Splash. You know, what happened to these movies? Like, there's no movies like this today. Take me back.
I'm with you. So you need to keep writing stories.
Yes.
Bring us back to that era. And we appreciate you doing that.
Absolutely. Hopefully this will sell and I'll bring you some more.
We would love it.
Yeah.
We would love it.
Tell them where to find you and where to find the book and all that good stuff.
Oh, it's everywhere, but you can get it most easily, obviously, via your local Barnes & Noble or just at if you're don't feel like hitting the bookstore, you can always order it online, but try to use your independent bookstore if possible. But again, the Amazon is always an option, but
it's a last resort.
Oh, I did an audiobook, so you can listen to it Audible next week.
Okay. Are you the reader of it?
Yes, and I use my best sexy Batman voice. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be an amazing experience.
Wait, can we get a sample of the voice before you go?
No, I'm not teasing.
Okay, all right.
I'm not teasing.
I did. Thank you for bringing that up because my last question. I could talk to you for a long time. This has been a fun for me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm enjoying what we're talking about, but I do.
Yeah, you two dorking out is awesome.
Sorry, man.
No, it's great. I love it. This is like an education by fire for me when we do episodes like this. So.
I have a note and I completely forgot because we just go off. But when you read the book, I thought I saw someone in the studio with, is it just you or is there other people playing characters within the book with the audio book? Just you.
It's just me. And I did not do the funny voices and maybe I should have, but I always get cringe out when I hear a voice actor attempting like a woman's voice or like a bad guy voice. It just, so I just read it straight through as like a dramatic reading of the book.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't want to like, there's less acting, but a lot of performance. So,
okay. Yeah.
I don't want to present a book with goofy voices because I'm not trained in that way. And also, you know, there's so many sentences in the book that are peculiar to my mind that I knew that a voice actor would have trouble performing.
Okay. Yeah. So,
you know, unless the voice actor has seen Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai in the Eighth Dimension, he's not going to catch, you know, the humor of the set.
Another misunderstood classic.
Yes. You know, unless they've seen all the RoboCop films, they probably won't get this joke that I'm trying. So I just wanted to, you know, I had to have control ultimately. And I feel good about it. They put some a little special effects, a little digital,
okay,
you know, machine to give it, you know, get out all the weakness, make it strong, make it perform.
Sure. Nice. Well, so I got some available Audible credits. I'll be using one.
100%.
I want to hear it
in my head. I'm like, I read it. But now I want to hear it, and I totally want to listen to it as well.
Yeah,
I was trying to get. I actually wrote like a whole heavy metal album to go with the book, but it just there was no way to like incorporate it that could meet Audible's standards, you know. So I'm just like, whatever. I'm not gonna spend an extra grand plugging in guitar riffs. Read it all the way through. So, but the next time I do this, I'm gonna include some riffs for the, you know, the trilogy, the Audible trilogy. Lots of
perfect.
Nice.
Do you play guitar?
I did. I do. I did more seriously as a high schooler and college kid.
Yeah, I know we've gone really long, and I don't want to keep you any longer than you want to be. But I did. You wrote a biography for the band The Killers,
right?
And yes. I'm wondering how that came to be. How'd you get hooked up with them? And
well, I showed up in Las Vegas and immediately fell in with this group of musicians, and they were all young and not that ambitious. So I didn't take it that seriously, and I was playing bass guitar in their band. And this band would eventually, you know, transform into what became The Killers. So I was playing with the drummer in a band, I believe that was called Romance Fantasy, and then it changed members. And then Brandon Flowers was a kid in the scene, very young guy in the scene. And then I kind of stepped away to start writing for the magazines and newspapers here in town, try to make money.
Because they're going nowhere.
Yeah. And I swear, like 6 months later, they were on the cover of, you know, Spin Magazine or whatever, with that fantastic first record. But I wrote that as kind of like a clip job, because I was covering the band as they ascended through the bars and into the club arenas, clubs. They did a tour of England that really exposed them to a bigger audience and got some attention. And so I had all these stories that I had already written. So I just kind of like assembled them into a book and was able to write the first biography, unauthorized biography of The Killers. I think they only had one or two albums out at the time, but it took off. They had just a furious fan base. They loved it. Picked up anything they could find, and that book was one of them. And I still get royalty checks to this day from that book. That's, you know, 15 years old.
That old. Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Again, they only had two albums out, maybe just one, but their rise was so meteoric. They were so hot. They were so in demand.
They were,
You know, I pitched a book to a publisher, and the publisher was like, yeah, we'll put this out right now.
We don't care.
We don't care what it says or if it's true. We're just going to put it out.
Yeah. No, it was all mostly, I mean, I didn't write fiction, but it was like I had unpublished photos as well that had never seen the light of day.
A lot of photos. Yeah.
That was fun to throw in there. And it was interesting. I had never done a book like that, like a quickie book for money. I wanted to see what happened. And it was fun. It was interesting. Everything in Las Vegas is fun and interesting. You just have to be careful that you don't let the fun and excitement get on top of you, because then it crushes you. Because Vegas is a little unforgiving in that way.
It certainly can be.
Yeah. My oldest daughter loves The Killers. Still to this day. She still does.
Wow.
Yeah.
If you think about it, they're sort of like the last, not wholesome, but they're like the last.
It's pure rock.
Pure rock. They're like CCR. That doesn't make any sense. But, you know, I mean, they're like a band that everybody can support and get behind. They don't really have any super annoying quirks, you know, Motley Crue. There's no Gene Simmons in the band.
There we go.
Gene Simmons, I saw all the time here in Las Vegas. I love interviewing him.
Yeah.
He was gracious and so much fun to be around. And like, he'd steal my tape recorder and drop it down his pants. And and I didn't care, because it was,
you know, Gene Simmons.
Right. He was good natured about it. It wasn't like aggressive. It was just, you know, he was bored sometimes with being interviewed, and so he wanted to
silly fun.
And
yeah, he's a silly guy. Yeah,
always appreciated that about him. And even Motley Crue was fun. Def Leppard, I got a chance to interview all of these legends as a
we
music
didn't even touch in your CD reviews and your yeah. rock reviews and all that stuff.
Band profiles, artist profiles. I loved writing that stuff. I loved meeting these heroes from my childhood, you know.
I bet.
Because they all have to do residencies on the Strip in Las Vegas. And so eventually me and a few other journalists would have to interview them.
Yeah, that's perfect.
I did not get to interview GNR. That would have been fun, but they were way too big still. They were too, they didn't need any coverage to sell booth tickets. You know, as soon as those tickets go on sale, bam, that's gone.
They're done. Was there anybody in there that you're like, I'm giddy to talk to?
Yeah. I mean, Def Leppard. Oh. You know, Joe Elliott and, you know, Phil Collins. I mean, they were just all great. They were the heroes of my youth. So there were some artists like I wasn't that familiar with, you know, for example, like, you know, Buckethead or something like that. I don't know what that is. I think I got real serious about my studies for a moment and it's like I wasn't paying attention to some of these musicians. But there are some musicians that I don't really know who they are. Alice Cooper was huge. Mm-hmm. That was a great moment. I said CCR. John Fogerty was wonderful to interview.
Yeah, that'd have been great.
And just total legends. And I'm glad I got to interview them before it was too late.
Sure.
Lemmy was another great interview.
Oh, shit.
God, he would have been awesome. Going back to what you're saying, there's a couple of that you didn't know who they were. But then you interviewed them and you're like, now I want to listen to their music that you now are in love with.
Oh, yeah, that's happened quite a few times, but not from obviously music from my era. It was like music just when I was in my 20s that I didn't pay attention to.
Right. Yeah.
I'd gotten married and whatever, you know, doing my stuff, getting jobs. And so it became less important. But, you know, bands like. Anyone who is an artist, like a in a rock band, I totally admire. But when you first listen to their music, you're like, "That's kind of junk." But then you get into it, and you kind of grows on you. That's life changing. Yeah. And I wish, you know, Les Claypool. That was a guy I never really understood. I didn't understand Primus, even though I really should have, because I think they came out my senior year of high school and I should have paid attention. I don't know what that was about. It seemed kind of annoying, like a cartoon band. Hmm. But when I started listening to the music, there's depth here. There's layers here. There's musicianship galore. This stuff is incredible. So that was a real life-changing moment interviewing him and learning about his work.
Okay.
Wow.
The worlds you can open up with digging into stuff.
Right.
It's amazing.
Won't tell.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I said it before, and I'll say it again. We could bullshit for another hour, but we you know, thank you for spending time with us. We don't want to keep you too long.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks for taking a moment and chatting with me about all this fun stuff. So I appreciate it. Let's do it again.
Yeah, it's been a blast
for sure.
Yeah, keep writing, and we'll keep talking.
I'll keep writing. You guys keep doing this great podcast. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Pleasure meeting you.
Have a good night.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The tavern is closed for now, but we'd love to have you back for more fun next time. Seriously, though, get your asses out of here.
Today is working for me. Do you believe that for yourself? Hey, I'm Pastor Julie, and I want to empower you through encouragement, inviting you to my podcast, Big Truth Encouragement, where I unpack living a faith-filled life. I created my podcast for the ladies, but gentlemen, you'll gain something too. So I invite you to listen to Big Truth Encouragement on ElectriCast and any platform where you listen to your podcast.
ElectriCast.
Hey there, I'm DC. I host the rock podcast, Back to the Arena, The Interviews. It's about a 30-minute podcast where I talk one-on-one with a band who has released new music. You can find us on all the best podcast sites like Spotify, Apple, Google, iHeartRadio, and more. If you're a rock fan like me, subscribe today to Back to the Arena, The Interview.
Electric Acid.